Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention back, I'm going to have to pick up the pace a little bit. So stick with me. All right, so here we are. And I will, in just a minute, sort of get to the views from
Mike.
Oh, this one, yeah. I'll get to the views from a bit from Washington, of course, and then also from Moscow and Beijing. Okay, so let's put all of what I just told you together in sort of one chart. And this chart shows it to you. So I look at nuclear capability through plutonium, highly enriched uranium, down to bombs. And then what did they have in 1999? And the reason I say that is because one of the things that Secretary Perry said when he did this Perry process, he said, we must deal with North Korea the way it is, not the way we want it to be. So what was like in 1999, it turns out they didn't have much. You know, maybe they had a little bit of plutonium, they had no highly enriched uranium, they had no nuclear tests, they probably had no bombs. And they had this one long-range rocket test, that's it. And by the end of the Obama administration, 20 to 40 kilograms, I already told you, of plutonium, even though the highly enriched uranium is very uncertain, I show here sort of an annual capacity of maybe 150 kilograms a year. Nuclear tests, 5, and some number of bombs, perhaps 20 to 25. And then missiles, they now not only have the short range, but they have intermediate range. They have solid rocket motors, and they have submarine launched, at least some initial capabilities. So this is a whole different picture. They actually have a nuclear arsenal now. And the ability to deliver it, in my opinion, at least anywhere in South Korea and in Japan. And so getting back to this, the question of the crisis, what's the American public, and even a lot of the American government today, focuses on this ICBM. Is he going to be able to launch, in other words, is he going to hold San Francisco and Los Angeles that he can nuke the United States? So that's what the focus is on. However, I claim, and that's what I've been trying to send back to Washington, if I look at their nuclear program, the crisis is here now, not when we reach an ICBM. Quite frankly, I'm not worried about him nuking San Francisco or Los Angeles. What I'm worried about is this possibility that there will be a nuclear detonation somewhere in Northeast Asia. Either the Korean Peninsula, possibly Japan, most likely the Korean Peninsula. How could it happen? Is he going to do an unprovoked attack with a nuclear weapon? Heavens no. You know, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, he's homicidal. He's already demonstrated that, but he's not suicidal. So it could be through misunderstanding, as I show here, miscalculation, sort of the overconfidence of a young man with nuclear weapons, about whom we know essentially nothing, and about the military guys who command the strategic rocket forces, we know nothing. Nobody talks to them. Nobody knows them. Nuclear weapon accident. Just think if one blows up inside of North Korea. Do you think they're going to admit it was one of theirs? It's going to be ours, they're going to claim. What are the consequences of that? You know, there is talk in the nuclear arena about de-escalating by using a nuclear weapon. That talk is often for Pakistan, India, for example. In other words, if he sees a conventional confrontation going badly, will he set off a nuke to demonstrate that, look, you guys better be serious? How about in an existential crisis, if it's really down to whether his regime is going to exist or not? And then the other one that people don't talk about, they talk about regime change. You know, that's what needs to happen. So if you try to do regime change today, if that guy has 20 to 25 nuclear weapons and you change him out, who gets to keep the nukes? Who controls the nukes? If you actually think about it, that might be one of the main reasons that the Chinese don't want to put the squeeze on them. What if they collapse that government? You have chaos in a country where we don't know anybody. So that's why I say, look, that crisis is here. This is just to remind you how bad nuclear weapons are. That was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in my classes, I try to get this message across to the students. And there isn't any photograph. There's nothing that you can show. You know, there's some movies you can show with nuclear weapons, the effects of blast of heat are. But what I find, and if you'll bear with me, I'm going to read you this eyewitness account from a survivor of a Nagasaki blast. His name is Akitsuki. The sky was dark as pitch, covered with dense clouds of smoke. Under that blackness over the earth hung a yellow-brown fog. Gradually, the veiled ground became visible, and the view beyond rooted me to the spot with horror. All the buildings I could see were on fire. Trees on the nearby hills were smoking, as were the leaves of the sweet potatoes in the fields. To say that everything burned is not enough. The sky was dark, the ground was scarlet, and in between hung clouds of yellowish smoke. Three kinds of color, black, yellow, scarlet, loomed ominously over the people who ran about like so many ants seeking to escape. That ocean of fire, that sky of smoke, it seemed like the end of the world. Keep that in mind if we think about a nuclear detonation on the Korean Peninsula. 25 million people in the Seoul area, only 30 miles or so from the DMZ. That's the crisis. Don't have to wait for an ICBM. So that's how we have to deal with this. And it was one bomb. Again, remember, it was one bomb, one city destroyed. So it is like Secretary Perry said, we have to deal with it the way it is. So again, back to the presidents. So Clinton faced, don't let him build a bomb, he succeeded. George W. Bush, don't let him build a bomb, he failed. President Obama, don't let him build an arsenal, and he failed. So what's President Trump's challenge? We can talk about denuclearization, but the challenge is don't let happen what I just read. No use of a nuclear weapon anywhere in Northeast Asia. The Korean Peninsula as well. So that's his challenge. So if you want to think about it, so how are you going to fix this problem, you got to think about that has to come first. You can talk about getting rid of nukes, you know, forever, but you want to make sure they're not used. And so that's why it's important. So as we look at this, you know, how is this crisis going to end? Is it going to be peaceful surrender of nukes? You know, highly unlikely. Regime collapse? I just told you. I'm actually concerned about that almost more than anything else. Military action, you can set back their program. You cannot eliminate it because we don't know where those 20 to 25 weapons are. Or even if they're 15, we don't know where they are. Regime transformation, sort of a soft landing. Is there some way one can still look at a diplomatic way to do this? So first, you know, what I've promoted is we got to talk to them. You got to talk to them as to how to prevent the use of a nuclear weapon. And then in the long term, you talk about nuclearization. So I just have taken you through all of these. Or the military, you know, I've gone through and looked at all the military sites and so forth. Again, we can wipe some of them out, no question. You can do some of it without much damage. You can close up their testing tunnels, but we can't get it all. And the consequences, as General Secretary Mattis said, if this goes to a military solution, it is going to be tragic on an unbelievable scale. And so the military solution, the consequences are not acceptable. So what do you do? So this is what I've been trying to promote. As I just told you, no use. That's first and foremost. That's not a negotiation. That's a discussion. Second, then, you know, can you get back and what I've tried to lay out is sort of halt, roll back, and eliminate. But that eliminate, that's a long time off because a lot of things would have to happen before their security concern can be overcome. So that's a big issue. And that's going to require this fundamental change in relation to what I, you know, call coexistence and interdependence. And it's going to take cooperation. So what about the Russians? I was asked a question in between. What about the Russians? So they had this missile launch on May 14th. Putin's comment, he warns against intimidating North Korea after that missile. Don't intimidate him. He says, I would like to confirm that we're categorically against expansion of the club of nuclear countries. He's against them having nuclear weapons, but he says, don't intimidate him. Don't push him in a corner. So the Russians have a very different view of that threat than we do. So what about the Chinese? Well, you know, as you know, at the Trump-Xi Jinping summit, Trump said North Korea is looking for trouble. Before that, China decides to help, that would be great. If not, we'll solve it ourselves. And he says, I explained to the president of China, another one of his tweets, that a trade deal with the U.S. will be far better for them if they solve the North Korean problem. Quite frankly, that's quite naive, because they have a bit of a different deal. And to think about trade for nuclear weapons, I'm not sure of that. But so how does China look at this? They also do not want the North Koreans to have nuclear weapons. But they're not willing to do what it takes to bring Kim Jong-un to his knees. And what you usually hear, they don't want a million refugees going across, you know, the border. But they also may not want to have the chaos with nuclear weapons with a regime change. So they support denuclearization. They're willing to put some more squeeze on, but they're not willing to bring them to their knees because they think that's worse. Okay, I'm going to skip this part and maybe we'll come back to it. So if I can have, can I have your help to switch on? Oops. Okay, get to number three. I had some photos up here of the brutal regime and then also of the real people of North Korea. And maybe if we have time, I'll come back. Thank you. I'll come back to that because the pictures are worthwhile seeing. It's a picture that I try to show that there is another North Korea beside the one that you see. But first, I need to get you through this as advertised with Iran. So will that deal hold? So again, you know, President Trump at his news conference says the Middle East is a disaster. North Korea will take care of it, folks. We're going to take care of it all. I just want you to know I inherited a mess. So he's going to take care of it. But somehow, I'm not reassured by those comments. So I already told you what he faces. You know, his job is make sure that weapons aren't used. So you got to talk to him. And then when we go about Iran, Prime Minister Netanyahu in 2013 made this speech where he showed the bomb and the red line, and he showed how close they are. And then you see Secretary Kerry and his counterpart, Minister Zarif, across from him, the deal. And the deal was to move Iran away from the bomb. Go back and think about North Korea, putting the pieces in place for the option. That's where Iran was. So Iran had put the pieces in place. I'm going to show you that in a minute. And Trump, but in the meantime, just to lead up to this, he also, as you remember, during the campaign said, the nuclear accord is the worst deal ever negotiated. Okay, so how close were they to the bomb? Back to the diagram of the three things that are necessary. In the plutonium highland-enriched uranium, they don't have plutonium as far as we know. They had a reactor that was getting reasonably close to operational. And they had enrichment capabilities that they had demonstrated, but they said they only used it for civilian nuclear power, not for bombs. In other words, low enriched uranium. However, when you put all that together, they were, in my opinion, in 2013, sort of weeks to a month away from being able to turn those centrifuges that were cranking out low-enriched uranium, just replumb them to crank out high-enriched uranium. So it will weeks to a month, you know, for one bomb. Weaponization, it turns out we knew that North Korea was doing tests of these implosion tests. They call them cold tests. You put something inside other than plutonium, get the high-explosive lenses around them, and you watch how you can implode those. North Korea did some 80 of those back in the late 1980s. We also have indications Iran has done those sorts of things, you know, more than 10 years ago. So they're ready, and they're smart enough. I mean, they're people, they're scientists, they're engineers, are good. So they're ready, and they most likely had the ability ready by 2003. And then in delivery system, they actually wound up with a much more vigorous missile testing program than North Korea. So we would basically say that they're ready, they just hadn't put the pieces together, and that was the idea of the deal. Now the history, I can only give you a real quick version. The Americans, this is part of the American Atoms for Peace, right? We were buddies with the Shah, so we built their first reactor. We educated their scientists, as I told you. And then the Shah actually had big plans. He was going to have Germany build them back when Germans were still in the nuclear power business, build them actually 20-some nuclear power plants. But then, you know, he ran out of luck. In 1979, Ayatollahs took over, and they said that nuclear weapons are immoral. We're not going to do them. Then they were gassed by Saddam Hussein, and the rest of the world said nothing. And so they looked like at that time they got serious about their nuclear program, and so they stepped it up. And then in the 1990s, they went shopping, as I just told you. They took advantage of that international network, and by 2002, they were still saying, look, we're only interested in civilian nuclear power, but one of the resistance groups actually found out that they have a secret enrichment plant at a place called Natanz. And they said, okay, yes, it's true. We have this secret plant, but we have to make it secret because we thought you guys would bomb it. We only did this for nuclear power, not for nuclear weapons. And yes, we're willing to deal with you. And they started dealing with the Europeans, the Americans, and the Bush administration refused to talk to him. And so that went on. Then in 2009, it turns out there was yet another secret plant called Fordow that was discovered, this one deeply buried, which would make them a little more immune to it, all of that. And then in 2013, they had a new president elected, Rouhani, and he showed some flexibility. So bottom line was they were close at the option, and what was the deal going to do? I was involved with Secretary Bill Perry. I saw the Iranians back during Ahmadinejad tenure, and we met with his security advisor in The Hague. And they were trying to convince us that all this stuff they're doing is just civilian. They don't have any military. And He told us that, look, there's a large gap between civilian and military. And I said, no, it's a hairline. If you want to make it a gap, you can go ahead and separate and do things. What they did for the next 5 years was just narrow that gap even more. Well, and he came in and he was interested in actually opening the gap. And so I met with Minister Zarif, with a couple of other colleagues of mine in New York, just before the UN meeting. In September 2013, and Minister Zarif at that point actually told us, hey, we're serious. We're going to go ahead. We're going to do the things, and we're going to do whatever it takes, for example, in this Iraq reactor that could make plutonium. Make sure you guys are comfortable with that. And we're willing to walk away from this uranium enrichment. And indeed, then the United States, by November, signed the first agreement with the so-called P5+1 to work with the Iranians. And so one of the very interesting aspects that one has to ask, I won't be able to do that justice, but why were the Iranians willing to do that when the North Koreans, these guys were hedging all the way. And even though they were interested in some dialogue, but boy, they never gave up this idea of having their weapon there in their back pocket. And the Iranians seem to be. And in my discussions with them in September, Mr. Zarif told me, and I didn't believe him, but then it sort of grew on me. And he basically said, Iran is worse off. We're less safe with nuclear weapons than without them. In fact, we're less safe if we even appear to be acquiring nuclear weapons. And he said, the reason for that is right now, he says, we're hegemon in the Middle East. And if we develop nuclear weapons, we invite others in. And what he meant, of course, was Israel and the United States. So I think they actually made the decision that they can put the nuclear weapons in sort of the back corner. and put it back there for a while. Maybe not forever, who knows? But for the time being, they don't want the nuclear weapons. And so I'm not so worried about whether they would cheat on this. I'm much more worried about the whole thing develops. And then this joint comprehensive plan of action, actually the negotiations for that, were just, in my opinion, were just incredible. It was one place where science was supporting those diplomatic negotiations better than almost any other example that, I can think of. And that is the guy on the left is Secretary Ernie Moniz, who's a card-carrying nuclear physicist from MIT, who happened to be Secretary of Energy at the time, has been a friend of mine for at least the last 30 years or so. Talking to him is the guy who's the head of the Iranian Atomic Energy Organization. Got his PhD in nuclear physics at MIT. So these MIT guys were negotiating together. And then the technical stuff of this agreement is just amazing. And here it is. I'm going to walk you through in terms of what the agreement actually does, because there's been so much discussion in this country about how bad this deal is without looking at the deal details. This is from Carnegie Endowment of International Peace. They wrote a very nice paper called Parsing the Iranian Deal. So what they had before was 16,000 some centrifuges that were operating, and they agreed to go down to 5. So one of the lessons was the Bush administration wanted 0. The Israelis wanted 0, no enrichment. Kerry, Moniz finally said, okay, we're going to have to live with some if we're going to get a deal. We're not going to let them enrich, you know, past the low enrichment level, but we're not going to go for a 0 option. And then we'll have all these posters. You can actually see the details of that. And the most important one is the one in blue, which actually they had already piled up a large stockpile of low-enriched uranium that could be used for reactor fuel. And it turns out that was the most dangerous stuff in Iran at the time, because once you make the low reactor fuel, even though it's only 3 to 4% LEU, you've done half of the work that's required to go to 90%. And so that stuff would be an enormous inventory. They agreed to go from 10,000 kilograms down to 300 kilograms. Again, that's an enormous change. The Fordo site, that's that deeply buried site. So that really worried the Israelis, worried the Americans, because we can't, it's hard to get down there with a bomb and to destroy that. So they said for that one, 15 years, no uranium enrichment, no centrifuge R&D, no nuclear materials down there. And all of that was spelled out. And actually, I thought great idea was to turn that into an underground scientific research facility where there would be coordination of Americans, Iranians, and others, maybe to perhaps build some of the base as to what it takes to build a relationship. In terms of the reactor, again, this is one of those things. It's a lot like those two big reactors in North Korea that nobody pays attention. They were building a reactor that could have made 10 kilograms of plutonium per year. And they were within a year or two of completion. They decided to gut the whole thing. They actually take the core and entomb it. And then they, again, the U.S. here had the sense of saying, no, it's not that we're going to say no reactors ever. Just build a different reactor, one that makes much less plutonium, and agree to take the spent fuel, which has the plutonium in it, out of Iran. And the general agreement was it would go to Russia, which would be good. So again, that from a reactor standpoint, that's a huge, huge concession. On the basis of my discussions with Zarif and his technical people in New York, I never thought they could get that far. And then when it comes to IAEA verification, and Tariq is there, I'm sure he can comment on that better than I can, quite amazing of what they agreed that they would actually do. And again, here are all the details of that. And so, you know, one of the criticism is that some of these concessions would only last for like 10 or 15 years. And then after that, you know, the Iranians would go ahead and build bombs like crazy. But it turns out they still, I mean, their agreement says they're never going to build a bomb. You know, they actually agreed that they would abide by the NPT. Now, does that mean they never will? Of course, we don't know. You know, never is a long time. But this was really quite amazing. So now, however, to get to the P5 plus one, you know, that's the P5 members of the Security Council in Germany, what Kerry and company had to do was what I call is sort of decouple the nuclear problem that I just told you from the rest of the Iranian problem. And that's a huge concession, actually. And it didn't include the missiles, which is too bad, but they couldn't get to the missiles because the other countries, particularly China and Russia, they don't care that much about the missiles in Iran. We're the ones that are worried about the missiles. Right? We're going to put a ballistic missile defense system into Europe against the Iranians. So we're the ones that really care about them. They couldn't get the Chinese and the Russians to come along. Then, of course, we also care about what are the Iranians doing in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, with the Hezbollahs. You know, they support terrorism. How can you make a deal with these guys? Well, they decided to decouple this nuclear front because they wouldn't. Do the Russians care about those things? Russians are working, you know, right now sort of along with the Iranians in Syria because they think there's a different solution to Syria. So that's, again, one of the lessons there is that allowed them to make the deal. Is the deal a good deal? What I'm here to tell you from a nuclear standpoint, this is better than anything that I thought they could actually pull off. If you look at the whole thing, there are lots of issues, concerns. My feeling is if we look at the next 10 to 15 years, however this plays out in Iran, I'd much rather have it play out without having Iran have nuclear weapons than with Iran having nuclear weapons. And then, of course, you know, there's also the issue, you know, Obama administration said very specifically, we didn't do this on the hope, you know, that Iran would turn a whole different color because, as you know, the Iran population, I think something like 2/3 is less than the age of 30. And they don't like the Ayatollahs. You know, they don't like a lot of the restrictions that are placed on them. How will Iran turn out? But they also have the, you know, the IRGC, as it's called, the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And they control a lot of business. They control a lot of what's going on. So there are all these opposing forces. I don't know how Iran's going to wind out in the long term, but I'd much rather have them be away. So lessons learned. Okay, John Bolton, he wrote this book, Surrender is Not an Option, on the agreed framework. I already told you, driving a stake through the agreed framework. President George Bush was there with the Axis of Evil in January of 2002. And Bolton then said in that October 2002 meeting where they sort of caught up the North Koreans and said, you guys are cheating. He said, we went straight for the agreed framework jugular. Okay, so that was their view. But as I already told you, Bush administration, that was not prepared. So it's one thing to kill an agreement. It's something else not to be prepared for what's going to happen. And that's the lesson for Iran. So as Trump comes in and says, I'm going to kill this, the worst deal ever made, he better have a plan. We didn't have a plan. What do we have now? We have North Korea with a nuclear arsenal. That's not good. So I say, let's not repeat the North. You know, and the things that Trump here has tweeted, I mean, from my standpoint, are really troublesome. Iran was in its last legs and ready to collapse until the U.S. came in and gave it a lifeline in the form of Iran deal of $150 billion. I mean, that's nonsense. You know, they were much more of the hegemon in the Middle East than being ready to collapse. If you really believe that, you know, it is really difficult as to how you're going to make the world a better place. Then he also said he put them on notice. So instead of this, my view is we have the deal. It moves them away from a nuclear. We have inspection rights that are better than anything we could get. And Iran is still causing a lot of difficulty in the Middle East. That's what we should be working on with the Russians and Chinese as to how we come to the same thing. Iran and North Korea side by side, I essentially showed you most of that. So the lessons learned from North Korea, from what they did. So hold up your end of the agreement. You know, we didn't do enough of that. In 1994, that new Congress was elected. They were determined to kill that deal right from the beginning. If you have that sort of controversy within your country. It is very, very difficult. It came back to haunt us. Then focus on the intent, not just the capability. We're watching the North Koreans' capability. Their intent was to keep a hedge, and because they didn't trust us. And then breakout can happen quickly. You know, indeed, that breakout has been increased from a few weeks or months to a year or so, if they would decide to go actually ahead. And breakout meaning making enough highly enriched uranium for a bomb or two. However, breakout is one thing. Building a nuclear arsenal is something totally different. And what happened, North Koreans built a nuclear arsenal while we were not talking. Okay, they may have been cheating while we were talking, but they broke out and built the arsenal while we were not talking. So again, keep that in mind. You know, it's difficult to prevent that with sanctions. So building a nuclear arsenal takes much longer, and then be prepared for the breakout. North Korea is a good example of how the U.S. and others were unprepared. I just told you that it's difficult to rely on the international community. Other countries have different points of view, different objectives than we do. So lesson learned again from North Korea. The other countries are going to hedge, and much less progress is made for them building an arsenal while we're talking. Okay, I can see you probably haven't seen almost anything that I've shown up here, which is unfortunate. But this one you should see. So here, you know, are we at a hair trigger then as Trump takes over with Kim Jong-un? And so how do we avoid that catastrophe? So, as you know, Trump can switch things, you know, on a dime. So a couple of months ago, he said on Face the Nation, he said, you know, Kim has stayed in power despite efforts by a lot of people to take it away from him. So obviously, he's a pretty smart cookie. So maybe we can talk to him. So lessons from the DPRK for Iran need informal diplomacy. The Iranian diplomacy was set up informally, quietly for months before we actually heard about it in 2013. Send the high-level team, send the A-team. White House commitment is important. Develop solidarity as much as you can among the negotiating partners. Be willing to take risk. Don't go for zero. Somebody in this North Korea thing has to take a risk. It's not going to be the North Korean. Delink nuclear from the other issues. You got to question that. You know, what about the human rights? There's more and more, it's coming together now. Say the human rights in North Korea are just terrible. But if we're going to wait to solve human rights, are we going to solve the nuclear problem? And the disaster associated, as I read for you, for explosion of an atomic bomb, that's a human rights problem. Access to nuclear facility is important. We've learned one heck of a lot. The pressure is important, but the effect of sanctions, for example, North Korea and Iran are very, very different. And then understand what the other side wants. So I already told you what we need to do is prevent a nuclear detonation. I think we should send the presidential envoy, not to negotiate, but to talk and make sure we understand each other. And so then just to wrap this part of it up, in terms of what I'm, at least what I'm trying to advise the, our government for now, is get in, talk to them, make sure there's that we understand that any use of a nuclear weapon is a catastrophe. So what we want from them then, in sort of setting the stage for the halt and then rollback, eventual elimination, is nuclear testing. So today, nuclear testing is really important. If we're really going to worry about an ICBM, they not only have to have the rocket, but they got to be able to make a warhead small enough that can survive stockpile to target. So, and a missile launch moratorium, that's what we want. Halt the reactor operation, at least make no more plutonium, and then at least let us into the centrifuge facilities that I saw. I didn't say it specifically, but they have to have other ones beside the ones that I saw. If you go back to CBID, that we have to see everything, you're not going to get anywhere right now. So I would settle for being able to see, again, what I saw last time, to have a better idea what else they have someplace. And then what can we do? Well, agree to revisit the peace treaty idea. You know, we're still technically at war from the 1953 armistice. Confirm the sovereignty, that we don't intend the regime change. Partial sanctions relief. Actually, sanctions are most effective if you offer to relieve them. That's when they're most effective. And then perhaps have, with the new president in South Korea, go back to this Kaesong industrial complex and other actions. And then if you're going to say, what do we need to do for them, you know, in this sort of halt and rollback, ask them. If you don't ask them, you don't know. So then it's just to go back in a rollback. So I've sort of laid out, I won't go through this in any detail, as to what are the major things that would indicate they're actually starting to roll back, that you could then make the case to the citizens of the United States and to the world community that they've taken some serious steps to at least roll back that program, and then what we would need to do in return. Certainly major sanctions relief, perhaps conditionally suspend the next round of the military exercises. And the North Koreans have made, you know, a few proposals over the last few years. And then sort of for the grand bargain, you know, it's generally believed now, people say, well, there's no way North Koreans are going to give up their nuclear weapons. And I think that's true for right now. They're not going to give up their nuclear weapons. We can sanction them, whatever. We can have China lean on them more. They're not going to give up their nuclear weapons. So does that mean they will never give up their nuclear weapons? I don't think we should say that. I don't think we should assume that. Because if you really look at North Korea, those guys are very isolated. You know, we'd like to think of the fact that, hey, they and China, you know, once upon a time, they're as close as lips and teeth. Let me tell you, they're not as close as lips and teeth. And certainly just from my discussions with the North Koreans, I think they actually, they're more concerned about the Chinese than they really are concerned about us. And so they don't like to be beholden to the Chinese. 85 to 90% of their economic traffic right now is with China. They don't like that. And so they don't want to be beholden to the Chinese. So we actually have a chance. Kim Il-sung in 1992, when he made the North-South Declaration, I believe that he actually made the decision that maybe the Americans are less of a threat than either the Chinese or the Russians, who he also thought abandoned them at that time. And so if you look at that, there's actually, in my opinion, there's sort of a hope of that. But how do you get there? How do you get them over this current problem? And that's what I call this sort of coexistence. First of all, actually be able to convince them that we're not after a regime change. So that takes time. Interdependence, actually, the more economic independence that you can have, and the more it can be a sort of a longer range affair, the more effective that can actually be. And in my view, and this is way out, I think it would be rejected by almost all of the policy people in the United States. I actually go back and say, you know, this light water reactor deal, you know, maybe that was sort of the best idea that was there. It was going to be, we're going to be in North Korea for 10 to 12 years. We're going to be building with the South Koreans, the Japanese, these light water reactors. We've got our people on the ground. We're spending money. We're interfacing. We're telling them and teaching them how to make nuclear reactors safe, how to do the regulatory environment, how you do the economics of all of that. If you do that for 10 to 12 years, guess what? You might actually, you know, develop some rapport that might have them think about the United States differently than they do now. And then in addition, medical isotope production reactor, a little research reactor. They've got nothing now, essentially. The one that the Russians built them in 67 is sort of limping along. Do that. Do a research reactor. Access to space. For now, say, Mr. Mortimer, you can't fire these things off. You know, that just sets our public off. You can't do that. So at first, give them access to space. Have the Russians launch their satellites. Okay, can launch satellite. And then for the longer term, actually say, is there something you could work out in the space that they could have this space station, the space launch place that they've put together, spend so much money, and actually do civilian launches you know, that they would have to make sure that they're internationally verified. And then economic and educational initiatives. So this is far out, particularly now when you have this daily concern about missiles being launched. But it's what gives me the hope that perhaps, you know, with action for action, you can sort of walk down this, but you're going to have a long-term sort of philosophy. So that's it. Let me stop here and see if there are any questions.